Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, every week here on France 24 with a panel of four distinguished international journalists, bringing you unique insight and discussion of the biggest events of the past 7 days. In a week that's seen unprecedented US intervention in Iran, in a pre-dawn operation codenamed Midnight Hammer, seven so-called silent assassins, the B-2 Spirit bombers, flying 18 hours from Missouri into Iranian airspace to fire 14 of the world's most powerful bombs at the main enrichment site at Fordo and at Natanz. The overall attack involved 125 fighter jets, several strategic feints, and a submarine fire too. Not a shot fired in response. Complete and utter obliteration, claimed President Trump. Iran hit back later at the US with ballistic missiles targeting the American base at Qatar, though it telegraphed in advance. 24 hours later, a ceasefire agreed between Iran and Israel, holding so far after a questionable start and presidential outrage.
You know what, we basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the fuck they're doing. Do you understand that?
And it's been a week that's seen another high-profile message leak on the Signal app. This time, a private thank you note to Dear Donald sent by NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte that said, "Congratulations for your decisive actions in Iran, doing what no one else dared, and flying into another big success at The Hague. It was not easy, but we've got them all signed to 5%. Europe is going to pay in a big capital letters way, and it'll be your win." The leaker, President Trump, of course, he published it on Truth Social ahead of the NATO summit. "No harm done," said Rutte, the so-called Trump whisperer, who later went on to allude to him as daddy.
"Fight like two kids in a schoolyard, you know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes, then it's easier to stop them.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while you have to use a..."
And it's been a week that's seen thousands of Kenyans protesting against police brutality and government corruption in cities across the country. Security forces barricading President William Ruto's office as police fired water cannon, tear gas and reportedly live fire too as they clashed with demonstrators in Nairobi. At least 16 people were killed. The protest marking a year since a grassroots movement first took to the streets of the capital against the president's planned tax law, which spread nationwide after the deaths and disappearances of some of the demonstrators.
"We are here as the young generation to, we want a complete overhaul of the system. The system is rotten, the system is rogue, and we want a complete overhaul.
It's a peaceful march to represent those we lost, and we're here to also cry out for justice for them."
I'm delighted to welcome another brilliant panel with me this week, four celebrated correspondents in their fields of journalism. Joining us from Berlin, Stephen Erlanger, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent in Europe. For the New York Times, Stephen, welcome back. It is always a pleasure to have you with us. Stephen has reported from more than 120 countries in a career spanning four decades, including covering the Iranian Revolution of 1979. He's been Bureau Chief in London, Jerusalem, Paris, Moscow, Bangkok, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent in Washington, won the Pulitzer Prize twice for explanatory reporting on his work at Al-Qaeda in 2002 and 2017 for his international reporting of coverage of Russia. Stephen also awarded the Legion d'Honneur in 2013 for his journalism. Stephen, I see this week from your social media you've been highlighting the work of Victoria Amelina, who's posthumously won the Orwell Prize this week for her political writing on Ukraine. Stephen, if you can hear me,
I think it's a very moving testament from unfinished from a very promising writer and thinker who was killed by the Russians. It's a good indication of this ongoing war that, in a way, we don't like thinking about ongoing wars because they're tragic and they make us feel helpless, hopeless sometimes. And so I think we need things like this to shake us and shake us out of ordinary journalism and to remember that there really are very impressive people who are fighting for something they care about, which is their country, their freedom, their ability to have a country that has its own alliances. And it's a good reminder. We had that even at the NATO summit in The Hague, where I was this week.
We're going to get on to that, and it's fantastic to have you with us, Stephen. I also want to know about life in Iran in 1979. Not many people there reporting on that. Much to discuss. First, let's cross to Brussels. Let's welcome Maria Tadeo. Evening, Maria. Maria is widely respected. Good to see you this evening. A widely respected Europe correspondent for The Grand Continent, the Paris-based journal founded 6 years ago, focusing on geopolitics and European affairs. Before that, Maria was Brussels correspondent for Bloomberg, who was the first to break the news back in 2018 of the ousting of the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. That was 7 years, Maria, this month, and you have followed, I think, the path of his successor very closely, Pedro Sanchez, who, let's remember, he was instrumental in causing the downfall, and he's a political fighter going through his own problems, fair to say, right now.
Well, fair to say, and also the main protagonist and in some way at NATO. Of course, as you know, this week there was this idea that the Spanish would not sign off to this 5% GDP at NATO. This was a meeting where President Trump almost had a form of tailor-made summit just for him. And the idea was to get this summit over the finish line with no tensions, no problems. In the end, they got there. But of course, then one of the key issues that the Spanish brought up, which, by the way, they never in some way argued they would sort of not sign on to this document. But I think they bring up a very fair point, which is ultimately the money that is being sort of tossed around when it comes to defense. These are enormous figures for Europe. There's a real question mark around the funding. And also there's a real question mark around what European budgets are going to look like when you see that priorities are so majorly and hugely shifting into defense.
Was Pedro Sanchez playing grey man this week, Maria, just staying well out of the way?
No, well, it's interesting because the Spanish government and the Spanish prime minister on the Monday and Tuesday, of course, this was the days prior to the NATO summit, they did worry that something could go wrong. They did worry that they could be targeted by Donald Trump. And of course, there's an negotiation to the trade deal, remember, between the European Union and the U.S. I think just to be very clear, at no point they argued they would not sign on to this declaration. They always said they would agree to this declaration. What changes with the Spanish is they argue this 5% number, in some ways, it's a number that came out of thin air. And it is. This was a number that the United States wanted, that the Secretary General Mark Rutte, and we can maybe talk about this later, really went out way to get this number over the finish line. What the Spanish argue is that NATO should focus on capabilities and they would deploy a percentage of GDP that is much lower, but they believe will get them to those capabilities. I think the real question, and this is why we've seen sort of the Spanish take an interesting line yesterday at the European summit, is that they believe in some way they held out, and also they maintained a form of dignity in a summit. It was very much designed around Donald Trump.
OK, we're going to get on to Spain's Trump problem or Trump's Spain problem, whichever way you want to call it. Great to have you with us, Maria. With us in the studio this week, Janine de Giovanni. Great to see you, Janine.
Great to see you.
Janine, seasoned war correspondent, spent 3 decades covering conflicts in the Middle East, Africa, the Balkans, for The Times, Vanity Fair, Newsweek, The New York Times, The Guardian, producing documentaries for the BBC, a multiple award-winning author too of 9 books, including The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. And Janine, also CEO of The Reckoning Project, which trains journalists on how to document war crimes in Ukraine and the Middle East too. Great to see you. Now, last time you were on the programme, you had just arrived with The Reckoning Project in Ukraine. Tell us about life there, what you saw.
Well, Ukraine's going through a difficult period. We were in Kharkiv. We have about 12 researchers spread out throughout the country documenting war crimes. Steve mentioned Victoria Amelina. She was a dear friend as well as a colleague. She worked for Truth Hounds, which is one of our sister organizations. Ukraine, there were strikes nearly every night, air raids. It's not Gaza-level air raids, but still, it was really, for the Ukrainian people, they've been going through this for 3 years. They're exhausted. They're tired of war. They want an end to it, and yet they will never renounce their what they want, which is territorial integrity. Mm. Nothing less. They want Crimea. They want the occupied territories. The level of criminality as well, the war crimes that are going on, the Office of the Prosecutor General, who we work alongside, has documented it's 139,000 and rising. And these are incidents. So on the battlefield as well, soldiers are tired. There's a mobilization problem. Russia, as we know, keeps pushing more and more and more troops, and Ukrainians are getting tired. These guys have been in the trenches for 3 years now. And the age, some of them are 45, 50. They mobilize between 26 and 55. So it's a long war. We don't see an end to it. President Zelensky has gained popularity immensely since the disastrous meeting in the White House. Mm-hmm. And we just, in terms of what we do, we just keep going, documenting war crimes, trying to build cases at The Hague and with domestic courts so that there is accountability for these atrocious acts.
And great to have you on the program. And for the first time, actually, in a long time, where the NATO summit, which we'll talk about, Ukraine not dominating the agenda. And we'll get into the reasons why in a moment as well. Let's also bring in Vivian Waltz, longtime correspondent for Time magazine, Fortune magazine as well, award-winning writer who has covered some of the biggest conflicts of the past three decades, including in Iraq, being shot at in Fallujah and Afghanistan as well. One thing that strikes me in the speed of news this week, Vivian, is the fact that we've just gone to air and there's another sort of jaw-dropping story in the US to which the Supreme Court has basically backed Trump against smaller courts taking action against him.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if you sort of turn away for an hour and turn back again and there's another big development. I myself spent the week traveling across Hungary. I have been back the last few days. And yes, indeed, the Supreme Court came out today with a ruling which could be really quite groundbreaking in support of President Trump. Effectively, what they said was that all these local judges, district courts, we call them in the US, can no longer make rulings that are applicable across the country. And this has been happening nonstop since Trump returned to the White House. Effectively, the strategy has been to fight every single ruling that he has made in some or other district court where you think that the outcome is going to be in according to what you want, and it then sets a precedent for the country. That is no longer going to be the case, which makes it tremendously difficult, particularly if you think about it for undocumented immigrants who are now expected to plead their case in, you know, every single district court across the country. It effectively gives Trump yet another tailwind to pursue his agenda.
And it was split two in ideological lines. So you had the conservative judges, six of them, three of which Trump appointed going for him, and three of the liberals voting against that. And we're also, I think I was just talking to David Smith, the Guardian Washington bureau chief, who was saying that the journalists inside the Oval Office press conference were scratching their heads. A, that he had just been called and Trump had all the information. So they're working out how quickly this could come into force. And it, as you say, it can be across the board, a vast impact over the coming months.
Absolutely. And, you know, this deals with the case on which this was ruled dealt with a very fundamental principle in the US, which is birthright citizenship. If you're born on U.S. soil, you are forever a U.S. citizen, no matter where you go after that. This has been something that President Trump has wanted to kill. It has not been killable until now. And it looks highly likely that it might well be now.
Yeah, Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, saying that they're looking as soon as September to bring that through. Great to have you with us, Vivian, as always, friend of the programme. Let's begin. 12:30 in Iran on Sunday, when the US began its attack, 10 days into the Israel-Iran conflict. The first move of Operation Midnight Hammer was the firing of more than a dozen Tomahawk missiles at the Isfahan nuclear facility from American submarines in an undisclosed location. Next came this, the Air Force, 125 fighter jets in what the US military called strategic deception, testing for surface-to-air threats. Next, at 2:10 in the morning, the first of 12 of the world's most powerful bombs dropped onto the deepest nuclear enrichment site in the country, Fordo, on the only plane that can carry them, the bat-shaped B-2 Spirit bombers. Two more then, so-called massive ordnance penetrators, MOPs, dropped on a third base at Natanz, already heavily targeted by Israel in the previous 10 days of strikes. President Trump giving an update at 10 p.m. D.C. time.
Tonight I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated. Iran, the bully of the Middle East, must now make peace. If they do not, future attacks will be far greater and a lot easier.
Iran didn't make peace, not initially. The supreme leader, said to be in hiding in an underground safe house, gave orders for what the regime called Operation Glad Tidings of Victory, which came the next night. 40 missiles, one for each US bomb, they said, aimed at the US Al Udeid base in Qatar, 200 kilometres across the Persian Gulf. No injuries, no damage reported, and not even really a surprise. Private diplomacy made public by President Trump. Not for the first time this week, he said on Truth Social, I want to thank Iran for giving us early notice. By Tuesday morning, a ceasefire had been agreed between Israel and Iran. At the same time, reports were emerging of a leaked initial intelligence report from the US Defense Intelligence Agency suggesting the American nuclear strikes didn't destroy core components, only set it back a few months. The president and the defense secretary refuted the analysis and blamed the press.
It was preliminary. It was low confidence. All right, so this is a... You make assessments based on what you know.
They said it could be very devastating, very serious.
Moderate to severe, and we believe far more likely severe and obliterated. So this is a political motive here.
Is there a leak investigation?
Of course. We're doing a leak investigation with the FBI right now because this information is for internal purposes, battle damage assessments, and CNN and others are trying to spin it to make the president look bad when this was an overwhelming success.
We had a tremendous success, and this is the New York Times. I call it the failing New York Times. It's going to hell. And CNN, which, as you know, very few people are watching. And you would think they'd do the opposite. You would think they'd want to say, this was an unbelievable success.
Which takes us to today. Supreme Leader, 86-year-old Ayatollah Ayah Khamenei, has since released a video, which is still in hiding, claiming that Iran won the day. On the 12-day war, in fact. And in doing so, he delivered what he called a slap to the face of the US. He said that exaggerated the impact of the strikes. To which we might say, Stephen, he might very well say that. But that's not what Khamenei is saying on the streets of Tehran, is it? He's saying that while he's in hiding. And it appears not the message, too, today, coming from the foreign minister of Iran. What's your assessment of the latest events?
Well, it's too early to have a very good assessment of the actual damage. Araghchi, the foreign minister, did say the damage was serious, but the biggest mystery, of course, is where Iran has put its large storage of 60% highly enriched uranium, because as long as that is out of sight, where the analysts can't see it, Iran could continue to enrich it and produce bomb-grade material. And that's the scary part, because if the war started by the Israelis was to end Iran's nuclear program, I don't think it succeeded. It certainly set it back. It may have set it back a year or more. We don't know. It's really much too early to tell, because quite a lot of the damage is 100 meters under the earth. So unless the IAEA gets in, or unless there's very good intelligence from agents on the ground, I think all these early assessments are simply that. We just don't know.
Yeah, I think there's some work. I think the space satellite imagery, what's called electromagnetic spectrum, working out what's going on, which could take weeks and months. They can kind of look at what's going on below ground. And also, of course, Stephen, Western intelligence, the old-fashioned intercepts of eavesdropping on Iranian officials. I want to mention something else, Stephen. Your article in the New York Times this week, where you question, you say, will Iran again sip the poison of a forced peace or escalate? And your reference to the comments made by the Ayatollah at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Tell us about that.
Well, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who was the founder of the Islamic Republic, was beset by Saddam Hussein, who went to war against Iran. Saddam Hussein was backed by the Americans then, and the Iranians teetered and they fought very hard. There were lots of deaths in the marshes. It went on and on and on. And at some point, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the guy in the portrait, decided in 1988 that the war was not going to end well, so he agreed to a ceasefire. And when he made a speech to the Iranian public, he said it was like drinking from a poison chalice, but it was something that he had to do to save the revolution. And I think that's what Khamenei has done too. I mean, much as Khamenei did after the Americans killed one of his top generals, Soleimani, he did one retaliatory strike against American interests after having warned the Americans that it was coming. And that was the end of it. And he did the same this time. So he could say to his people, we've hit the great Satan, we will hit the little Satan, which is Israel. We persist, we survive, the damage isn't that great, and the Islamic revolution continues. But I think Iran's in its weakest position in a very, very, very long time. I mean, its forward defenses have been destroyed, its proxies have been beaten up, its Israel and America can fly over its airspace without being challenged. And I think if they see that the Iran nuclear program is getting going again, I think the bombing will also start again.
Janine, listening to Stephen on the bombing potentially starting again, lots of caveats of where we are now, this kind of peaceful moment for the first time in 2 weeks. NBC, just take a look at this article, this headline this week. Trump navigates, they say, the most complex foreign policy crisis of his presidency. NBC talking about one truth at a time, as they point out. Much of this diplomacy there for all to see. It's coming out on Truth Social. And you've seen many conflicts and tactics. What do you think of the impact or the consequences of it being played out in this way, do you think?
So there's two really important points. One is the timing of these strikes. It happened right when the negotiations were going to begin again. Look, Tehran wants negotiations because they want the sanctions lifted. They want, in some way, there's even those in Tehran who believe that there could be trade deals begun or that they could enrich their own uranium and have the centers in another country like Saudi. This has been talked about. It's really interesting the timing of when Israel did this to derail the diplomatic process. Mm. Absolutely, possibly. The other thing that really strikes me, and there's not much talk about it, but I work for a human rights organization. Has anyone said that that Israel has basically ruptured international law and the UN charter's been, you know, mashed to pieces? Was there an imminent threat? I mean, Israel will say this was a threat to our security, but there was nothing at that moment, and they have yet to prove that there was a direct imminent threat. Now, I was in Baghdad, Steve was there as well, for months and months before the invasion, during the invasion, and then for years after. I'm getting terrible deja vu, because that was called a preventative war, right? Mm. But we sat there, we saw Hans Blix and the weapons inspectors come and go and say to us privately, there's no weapons of mass destruction. We know what then happened with Iraq. Poor Colin Powell was basically railroaded, as was Tony Blair in many ways, to hold up that bottle and say this threat will kill, this amount of weapons will kill so many people. I'm seeing that played over again. Iran has been demonized over and over again in the Middle East. The bully of the Middle East isn't Israel right now, the bully of the Middle East. And they were ready to negotiate. There's also something else, which I truly believe. The last time I was in Iran was 2016, right after the JCPOA. I haven't been able to get back in since. I couldn't get a visa. But when I was there then, there was this sense of awakening and of a rapprochement, that people really wanted to become part of the international community. There's a generation of young people who could be the next, similar to Gaza, an entire generation of future peacemakers that have been killed in terms of Gaza in Iran, who are now completely dismayed by what has happened. This, to me, was not a triumph. The IDF is gloating all over Twitter about, you know, our enormous success. We have saved the world from Hezbollah, from Hamas, and now from Iran. But what reaction will this have throughout the world in reactivating a revolt against, you know, the hegemony of what Israel's doing? So I think the two things, negotiations have been derailed, and we need to get back with someone like Rob Malley, who was the former Obama's chief negotiator with Wendy Sherman. He's now at Yale, so we need to pull him back in. Trump will never do that. And then to really determine whether or not and how Israel violated international law. Not that it's going to matter, but if you look at the ICJ and their determination, this was a clear violation of it.
Well, where things stand, Vivian, at the moment, the Israeli perspective will be to your point, under UN Charter Article 51, it's a preemptive strike. They reference the fact that they have this, they say, analysis of how close Iran had gone, not just weapons towards weapons grade at 90%, but enriched to 60%, but that it was going from the professionals to the military, that there were meetings being had. And let's remember as well, the Ayatollah had long threatened to eradicate Israel from the state of the map. So you have this will play out. And, you know, going back to Janine's points, it's fair to say as well, if history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes.
Well, absolutely. And
with caveats.
I too was in Baghdad before, during and after Saddam Hussein's, crushing defeat. And I think the one point that we forget, actually, this week is, if you go back to 2003, there's a good argument to be made that most Americans were for the Iraq War, how utterly wrong-headed it might have been, and it was. This is a war that was totally not supported by Americans. The figures were minuscule of those that thought it was a good idea. And in fact, you know, President Trump didn't bother to ask Congress as he needed to. So it's not simply a violation of, you know, UN, the UN Charter, which is what Israel has done, of course, not only in Iran, but also in Gaza. But it's also a violation of the US Constitution. Nobody seems to care. The real point about all of this is theater. It's performative. We did have a pretty good working Iran nuclear deal, which President Obama spent 2 years negotiating. President Trump came in 2017, and one of his very first acts was pulling out of it. There was absolutely no incentive for Iran not to accelerate its nuclear production after that. Of course they were going to, in the same way as, you know, countless other countries have no incentive now. And I don't think we talk enough about the truly terrifying nuclear arms race that's going on. We're not just talking about Iran. We're talking about North Korea and Pakistan and, you know, and Israel. There is very little incentive for any one of these countries to give up their nukes.
And with separate analysis suggesting it might be all the incentive for other countries to rush towards one, given what's been happening with Iran in the past few days. Maria, listening to the context from Iran, from Washington, in Brussels, how's this been seen? Because I guess some leaders were informed last minute from the president, others the morning after the night before.
Well, I think this week, one of the things that we've seen, and I'm sure that Steve can also agree with this, is that the European Union, first on this matter, clearly doesn't have a voice and it doesn't have any real weight. I think also another important thing is that we've seen that the European leadership is divided in how to tackle this. On the one hand, the German chancellor, I think, was very candid in saying we should stop talking about Israel in these terms, because in reality, they're doing the dirty work that a lot of Western countries, but also countries in the region, want to see. I mean, Macron was in a lot of difficulty to say, well, it's not illegal. He was very clear on that. But again, there was a real risk that I think, once again, you see that when it comes to the EU, this is split, is all over the place. But also, to me, there was something very meaningful on the Friday before the UN hit Iran. There was a meeting, remember, with the high representative of the EU, the foreign ministers of France and the UK, and at the time they all said we're working on a diplomatic way out that is led by Europeans. The reality is at that time, we know that the US was already starting to conduct this operation. So I think for the Europeans, it has manifested something that we know, but of course it's difficult to see for them. That is, they simply are not clear in the region.
Very interesting as well, listening to different leaders. So Keir Starmer in the UK, for example, asked the question whether he supported the strikes. He went out of his way to weave the question. He didn't give an answer. And yet we've heard, I think this week, Maria, from Spain's foreign minister, José Manuel Albares, condemning the strike directly, stated it's illegal and a dangerous escalation, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. But also, I think you have to see this in the context of the relationship between Spain and Israel is in an incredibly difficult, I would say probably now rock bottom bilateral relation. I think for the Spanish government, as you know, they have also taken a major diplomatic line and almost made it their mission to push through the cause of the Palestinian people. Obviously, remember, this is one of the European countries last year that recognized the state of Palestine. And then at the same time, they have been pushing just this week again to suspend a trade deal, a sort of economic association that takes place between the European Union and Israel. This is happening in the context of a very specific bilateral relationship. It's a very difficult relationship. This week, again, the Israelis said the Spanish government basically hates Israel. They're in a crusade against the Israelis. The Spanish obviously deny this. But I think these statements, you have to see them from what is already a difficult relationship going back maybe now a year. Also, I should note at this point, there isn't an Israeli ambassador in Madrid, so the channels of communication are also very limited.
Listening to Maria, Stephen, there is another school of thought put forward, isn't there? Pakistan put it forward this week, nominating him, they've said, for the Nobel Peace Prize. If this ceasefire holds, has he made steps towards greater pursuit of peace, Stephen?
Well, I think it was a very interesting choice because for Trump, there are a lot of people who support him who were very much afraid of getting into another Middle East war. And Junaid has expressed beautifully why this was such a mess in Iraq. But Trump did a kind of one and done thing. And I think he told the Iranians it was going to be one and done. It wasn't going to aim at the supreme leader. It wasn't going to aim at any military people or installations. It was only going to aim at the nuclear program. And he made it very clear that at that point, the U.S. was finished. He then convinced Israel that it had done as much as it was going to do. Iran, I think, was very happy to call a halt to all of it. And let's hope the ceasefire holds. You know, Trump keeps talking about obliterating. Well, very few things are ever obliterated. It can be rebuilt, but Iran has a real choice to make. Does it want to invest the billions of dollars it's already invested in restoring what can be bombed again? Or is it willing, finally, to put limits again, as it did in 2015, on its nuclear program in return for a welcome back to the world, to a loosening of sanctions? And this is a big question for the Islamic regime and for Khamenei, who, after all, is 86, I believe, and who has spent his whole life thinking that the United States is untrustworthy, and Trump has just proved it again to him. So it's a very difficult choice that he has to make. And I think for Israel too, you know, Bibi can crow about it, but, you know, it's nothing's finished. Iran isn't finished. Its nuclear program isn't finished. Iran still has agency, and nothing is done. So let's see what happens.
Well, given you've said that, Stephen, with a ceasefire in place at the start of the week, President Trump then went off to The Hague on Tuesday for the NATO summit in the Netherlands, evidently curated and streamlined for him. The main meetings were condensed into 24 hours. The main items on the agenda were getting NATO members to increase defence spending and, according to NATO sources, keep a capricious president committed to the alliance. And in the words of Stephen Erlinger in the New York Times this week, quote, to give Trump what he wants, a win on military spending. We're going to talk more about that with you, Stephen, in a moment. But it started well for the most powerful member of the alliance. A private message from the Trump whisperer, Mark Rutte, so full of praise and flattery that Trump screen-grabbed and posted it. Maria Tadeo was among the journalists fact-checking that it wasn't a spoof message from the NATO secretary. Maria, so began an unusual start to the summit that was evidently curated to be Trump-friendly.
Very much. And look, I'm very happy that you mentioned that, because the first thing that we had to do as reporters on that day was to check whether that message was real. And I remember the first thing I did was to call up NATO and say the president of the United States has published what appears to be private communication from the secretary general to the U.S. president. Can you confirm that happening? Can we get some sort of clarity as to whether this is real or not? I think the fact that you have to check whether or not a tweet, a message from the head of the U.S. government, Israel or not, already tells you a lot. Look, I think on the one hand, Mark Rutte, he had an obsession, and anyone who was there and covered the run-up to the summit, we all knew that this was an important meeting for the Secretary General, but also he was committed in making this very short. He didn't want any answers, he didn't want any problems, and he wanted a declaration. He went out of his way to make it happen in a way that would convene with in a way that he would be happy and in a way that he would be flattered. I spoke to a number of diplomats on day one, and I think it was interesting asking, is he doing too much now? Can you run in an office which ultimately reflects 32 countries just catering to one? A number of countries told me Mark Rutte knows how to talk to him and he will get this declaration over the finish line. What I would say, and I'd be curious to see what Steve thinks, is that on day two, especially from the Europeans, something changed. I think that comment about the daddy and at some point he's got to be tough on the kids, that didn't go down well. I think there was an idea that it was excessive, and once the declaration was done, a lot of that just was completely unnecessary. And today in Brussels, from a number of contacts I spoke with, I was told Mark Rutte got the job done, but also at a political cost in terms of the credibility when you look at the big powers in Europe, like the French, the UK, Germany. It was too much in day two.
Janine, it's interesting, this listening to Maria's point about daddy, that he had to step in with strong words. He said he was being figurative. He said he was alluding to him as a daddy figure because of the children of NATO with the other members, and they've grown up. He didn't quite match what he actually said, because he was talking about Iran and Israel fighting and daddy jumping in. Now, you've trained journalists to cover and document war crimes. I just want to try to train diplomats for the way they talk about conflict and how it's likened to. What do you make of the whole debate on A, the children, and the daddy?
So embarrassing. I mean, I find it absolutely shocking that it got, well, of course, not so shocking that it got leaked, but it's the absolute sycophancy over it. And it's falling in line with the history behind everyone else who's bowing to Trump in Washington, Columbia University, countless law firms that I've been, white shoe law firms like Skadden, who have all basically, taken the kneel for Trump. I can understand in some way needing to bring Trump into the club of NATO. That is important, because remember during his last term how excluded he was. He would often walk alone. Other leaders wouldn't walk next to him. He was an embarrassment. But I think going this far to absolutely, I mean, daddy, isn't that what they called Mandela as well? I mean, and Trump and Mandela. But I think what's important that came out of NATO, from my perspective anyway, is Ukraine. Because Ukraine, at the moment, it wasn't the lead on the agenda, right? And the main complaint coming out of Ukraine recently was that people said to me, we have been abandoned. And we've been abandoned by Gaza. And I'd say, look, you haven't been, because frankly, you are getting aid. You are getting a lot of support from Europe, France, Germany, the Netherlands, the Scandinavia. Everyone is supporting Ukraine in one way or another. But it's a war that's gone on for 3 years. There is this compassion fatigue. And as we know, Gaza is not getting any support. The latest incident of the shootings at the feeding stations, which are so inhumane. Stephen, your wonderful newspaper hasn't been covering it quite accurately. I mean, the language of how people are reporting it as well. Haaretz, the brilliant and courageous Israeli newspaper, has come out interviewing IDF soldiers who said they have been told to fire upon people going to the feeding stations. So this wasn't brought up at NATO, obviously, because it's not a NATO issue. But I do just want to point out that Ukrainians do feel collectively abandoned right now, even though there has been more pledges for more defense for them.
Stephen, Vivian, do you want to come in?
Sure. Honestly, I think the word daddy was quite appropriate. I mean, here you have the organization, 80 years later, they are still under the American command structure. There is no independent EU structure, within NATO. They are like children waiting for pocket money, effectively, and being told, you know, how much they have to save, which is this bogus 5%, which, of course, is never going to happen. And insofar as people increase their military budgets, a lot of that money is going to go back to the US defense contractors, because that's who they're going to buy hardware from. So including these nuclear warhead capable F-35s, each one of which costs like $100 million. So I just found it, just the whole thing, so appalling. And it's like we have not moved an inch on the whole question of European defence.
To which, Stephen, listening to Vivian's point, I guess it gets to the heart of what Article 5 is all about. The attack of one is attacking them all, but it's no good attacking one if the US isn't involved, because that's the whole concern about Russia, that they need the US. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to Janine's point as well, when Ukraine comes into the mix, and also the coverage on Gaza and the controversial Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Well, I'm not going to get into our coverage of Gaza. I mean, you can make your own judgments. On NATO, I'm less pessimistic, I have to say. I've been covering NATO a really long time. Europe has been a free rider, without question. Russia is in its fourth year of war on the European continent. And it was only in 2022 that Europe began to see it as a threat to itself. It's been very slow to do that. Even NATO, Trump aside, NATO has set new capability requirements in the face of a militarizing Russia, which has bigger ambitions, and given European allies basically marching orders about what they need to do to increase a weakened deterrent. And that's going to cost at least 3% of GDP for the next decade, and probably 3.5% of GDP. Now, I agree the 5% number was pulled out of the air by Donald Trump, and it's a shell game, et cetera, et cetera. But the 3.5% is real. Europe is rich. It's big. It should take a little more responsibility for itself. It needs to spend a little more money. And frankly, I'm not sure that without Trump pushing, as one of the Latvian leaders said at the summit, that NATO would be sitting around normally whining about 2% and coming to no conclusion. So I think to some degree, and, you know, I'm not a great fan of Trump, he has been pushing Europe to do what frankly is best in its own interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking of big and rich, this takes us to the denouement of the programme this week, because Wednesday, only Wednesday this week, and the world's third or fourth richest man, give or take a few bob, either side of $220 billion, we won't split hairs, Jeff Bezos arrived in Venice for the start of his days-long wedding to the former journalist Lauren Sanchez, stepping off his $500 million super yacht, Kourou, after, I'm sure, a very elegant foam party off the coast of Croatia on Sunday, taking a water taxi with the bride-to-be in front of organised press and a hidden army of bodyguards. Protesters against the Amazon founder have already made an impact, reportedly forcing the couple to choose a second-choice venue outside the city centre because of planned over-tourism demonstrations. Activists unfurled the giant banner calling for Bezos to pay more tax. Other visual protests being launched too, including literally launching a mannequin effigy of Jeff Bezos clutching an Amazon parcel with a fist full of dollars. The wedding said to be happening as we speak this evening. Maria, Venice is cited as an early cradle of capitalism, banking, bookkeeping, joint stock companies. It's part of the built-in sort of trade of it. The activist argument is exploiting the city. What's your take?
Well, this is a real debate, and it's a real topic on Italian TV. They've been going on about this for now practically 2 days. Obviously, a lot of that is because the Kardashians are there, I can imagine. look, at this point, I think there's a question, and really this goes back to the debate that's happening in Italy, but I think this is fundamentally the issue here, is you have someone who is, well, incredibly wealthy, incredibly rich, right at a point in which there's a real debate about the state of capitalism. I think also if you look at in New York and the candidate for mayor of New York right now, this is a real also zeitgeist in the U.S. You know, there's a real conversation about the state of capitalism, whether the idea of massive wealth inequality is increasing. And for a lot of Europeans, they do feel, especially when you talk to younger Europeans, that this has been sort of become a city for vacation. And beyond that, there's very little for a lot of the Venetians and the Italian public debate. And this is a real story. If you put on the Italian TV, this is on in every hour. There's this idea that there is no real future when it comes to the country other than becoming this deep museum. What is also interesting is that Jeff Bezos is perceived as someone who's allied and close to Donald Trump. So therefore, the government feels this idea to say, oh, but he's being very nice and he's given a donation of $3 million. But beyond that, look, I think there's a real conversation about capitalism excess. And for Italians, again, it's this constant story about summer and overcrowded and citizens and cities that are basically just living in person.
A quick thought, Vivian and Janine, 20 seconds each to end the programme, whether there's some sympathy, because this is a city with 65% of its economy coming from tourism. Vivian.
I don't think this was Venice's fault. They can't stop somebody from getting married in Venice. This is a question about inequality. You have Jeff Bezos earns $34 million a day. A day. So, you know, his $50 million wedding costs him one and a bit day's income. It's just mind-boggling, the inequality.
Sympathy in short supply. Janine.
Yeah, and also the vulgarity. I mean, I could go on about that, but the point is really that we're living in very dark times right now. There are several wars on several fronts. There's all kinds of, within America, a polarization that I have never seen. Sometimes I say, I believe we're headed towards a civil war. And yet these two could have gone off and had a very elegant, quiet wedding. Instead, they're just pushing this into people's faces who are deeply, right now, angry, frustrated, and basically not knowing how things are going to turn out. We're in a very complicated time right now.
Janine, thank you this evening. Thank you all to my panel tonight. Unique experience reporting on the ground. The insight, clarity you bring, it simply cannot be replicated by large language models and AI. Joining me in the studio tonight, we've had Janine DiGiovanni, journalist and author and CEO of The Reckoning Project, Vivian Walt, correspondent at Time magazine from Brussels, Maria Tadeo, Europe correspondent at Grand Continent, and from Berlin, Stephen Erlinger, chief diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. We will leave you with a viral moment of the week, the King and Queen of the Netherlands alongside President Trump, the King having just asked Trump if he slept well. If the Queen responded, well, that's what got attention. I've watched this clip several times. I can't figure out what she's doing. Maybe you can. I hope you sleep well. Join us in 7 days for The World next week.
Well, I hope you slept well.
It was great.
Yeah.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Actually, I'm just going to tell you.